This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, protesters block expansion of the Vail Ski Resort in Colorado. They say habitat for the lynx will be destroyed, but the developers say no one has seen a lynx for 26 years. Old power plants can produce 10 times more pollution than new ones. Air pollution is increasing because instead of closing, the old plants are producing more electricity than ever. Author Susan Zwinger takes us to the Arctic, where a raven and her own death court her in the white cold. And in the Earth calendar, it's bug hunting time for humans in Wisconsin. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Each winter, thousands of people travel to the snowy mountains of Vail, Colorado for some of the best skiing conditions in the United States. The Rocky Mountains are scenic and peaceful, but amidst the beauty of the evergreens, a war is being fought over the creation of a new ski slope. Last year, arsonists who opposed the project allegedly set fire to a restaurant and nearby buildings, destroying $12 million of property. Now, a recent battle over the slope shows the war is far from over. Stephen Westcott has more.
On July 1st, environmental activists gathered on Vail Mountain to protest the creation of a ski slope on the backside of the mountain. Protesters erected a 25-foot tripod in the middle of the road to block construction vehicles from beginning work on the new slope. An activist was suspended by ropes from the tripod. Soon after, officials brought in a cherry picker in an effort to take it down. Brian Hansen, a reporter for the Colorado Daily newspaper in Boulder, Colorado, was covering the story.
It was incredible. Activists were throwing their bodies in front of the moving truck, diving down in front of it. Authorities were dragging people off using pain holds, twisting arms back, twisting wrists, things like that, dragging people out in front of the truck. It finally made it up to the tripod, sat there for a few minutes. Things kind of calmed down, and when the authorities were sort of not looking, another activist locked herself down. It was Emily Wolf who locked herself down to the bucket of the cherry picker.
Five protesters were arrested that day, and others maintained a presence at the site until July 6th, when law enforcement officials from the U.S. Forest Service and state officers dressed in camouflage gear and bulletproof vests conducted an early morning raid on the protesters. Reporter Brian Hansen was among those arrested for refusing to leave the scene. Jonathan Stauffer, activist with the environmental group Colorado Wild, says he and others opposed the creation of the ski slope by the company Vail Resorts. Stauffer says the project includes clear-cutting an ecologically sensitive area.
It's a 885-acre clear-cut and 2,000-acre permit area, which is almost the size of Breckenridge, which is also a Vail Resorts-owned resort. The expansion is going into the Two Elks Roadless Area, which has been called by the Colorado Division of Wildlife, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Vail Resorts-owned biologists, one of the last best habitats for the Canada lynx in the state of Colorado. It's also a vital interconnect between the northern and southern part of the state, and thus vital to the Southern Rockies ecosystem.
The lynx is a wildcat that is a little larger than a bobcat. Porter Wharton, vice president of public affairs for Vail Resorts, says the company does not believe the backside of Vail Mountain is critical lynx habitat.
Neither do the scientists that have researched this issue. A lynx has not been seen in that area since 1973.
The debate over whether this part of Colorado is home to lynx has been going on for some time. Environmentalists say the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been dragging its feet on a proposal to list the animal as threatened. It's a delay, they say, which has allowed Vail Resorts' project to continue. Activists also say the Vail Resorts ski slope, which will be constructed on public lands leased from the U.S. Forest Service, poses other environmental problems. Emily Wolf, the woman who chained herself to the cherry picker during the protests, is with the environmental group Coalition to Stop Vail Expansion. She is concerned Vail Resorts will develop forest areas near the slope.
They also just bought the Gilman property, which is private property, and it's adjacent to the expansion area. So once the expansion area is completed, then this land is worth so much more money because it's now within just a small distance of the ski terrain itself. It's kind of hard to explain without seeing a map, but it would be a 40-minute drive to go ski from the Gilman property to Vail right now. But when the expansion's completed, it will only be a small gondola ride across 1 mile of national forest land.
Environmentalists also say the number of skiers going to Vail has declined in recent winters and that the new slope is not needed. Vail Resort spokesman Porter Wharton says the project has been in the works since the mid-1980s and says it has been approved by state and federal agencies. Wharton maintains the company is concerned about the environment and the protection of natural resources and says the company has tried to address complaints by environmentalists.
The project is smaller than originally envisioned. For example, it was supposed to be initially over 4,100 acres, and it's now actually going to be about 885, as I mentioned, in skiing. We were originally had the approval to clear 553 acres. We're only going to clear 329. We originally had approval to do 20 miles of skiways and roads. We're doing 12.
Despite reductions in the size of the project, environmentalists still want the project halted, and they say most local residents agree. However, Vail Resort's Porter Wharton says most of the noise is coming from non-residents.
What we have here going on now is a handful of primarily out-of-state professional protesters who have decided that they don't need to adhere to the law. They can ignore the law, they can ignore the science, and try to, despite the overwhelming amount of study and evidence that have indicated that this project is the most environmentally sensitive ski area expansion ever done in North America, they have decided that they want to stand in the way of it, or try to stand in the way of it.
Vail Resorts is building the ski slope on public lands that it has leased from the Forest Service. That lease runs well into the next century. Meanwhile, environmentalists such as Emily Wolf vow to continue fighting the project through the summer, both on the ground and in the courts. Prior to producing this story, I received word from Brian Hansen at the Colorado Daily that an activist had climbed 80 feet into a tree in an effort to stop loggers from cutting the tree. Hansen told me that loggers hired by Vail Resorts were cutting trees no more than 15 feet from the woman, and the last reports were she could be heard screaming in fear. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
A study just released by the Environmental Working Group and the Education Fund of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group reports that electricity generation from old coal-fired power plants increased 16% from 1992 to 1998. This has major consequences for the environment because the old plants do not have to meet the same air pollution standards that new ones do.
The increase since 1992 in the use of old polluting power plants has caused a dramatic pollution consequence, which is as much smog pollution as would be emitted by 37 million cars in a year, and as much global warming pollution as would be emitted by 44 million cars in a year.
That was Rebecca Stanfield, clean air advocate for the U.S. PIRG and one of the authors of the report. She says the reduction in pollution anticipated by changes in the Clean Air Act are being nullified.
The main thing to note here is that as we move towards using these plants more, we're basically sending all of our clean air efforts up in smoke. A good analogy is if you look at the auto industry. In 1970, cars were a lot more polluting than they are now. But because there's more and more cars on the road, the pollution that comes from automobiles is actually on the rise. The same is true for power plants. So even though some power plants are cleaning up to some degree, we're using the old dirty ones more and more, and the effect is devastating for public health and the environment.
When the Clean Air Act was amended in 1990, old coal-fired power plants were exempted from meeting tougher clean air standards that applied to new plants because it was assumed that they would soon be retired. Again, Rebecca Stanfield.
Since the Clean Air Act was written, older power plants have enjoyed an exemption. And the idea was that these plants would be retired and be replaced by clean sources of energy. And Congress bought that from the utility lobbyists, hook, line, and sinker, and has actually maintained this exemption in the Clean Air Act amendments of 1977 and 1990. So that theory has turned out not to be true at all. What's actually happened is that those plants are creating even more electricity and more pollution than they were years ago. So closing that loophole in the Clean Air Act is a very critical part of reversing this trend.
The differences between emissions from old plants and new ones are substantial.
It's not uncommon, especially when you're looking at something like sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain and the deadly fine particulate matter that people breathe, to see an older plant that is emitting 10 times more pollution than a new plant sitting right next door.
A primary factor contributing to the increased use of the old plants is said to be the deregulation of the electrical market, which began in 1992. Older coal plants with fewer emissions controls can produce electricity more cheaply than newer, cleaner ones. In a deregulated market, they can bid successfully to supply power to the wholesale market. The result, according to some observers, is that instead of phasing out the old plants, some utilities are actually taking them out of mothballs and putting them back into service. United States Senator Jim Jeffords from Vermont wants to close the loophole in the Clean Air Act that favors the old plants. Vermont, like all states in the Northeast, is particularly affected because prevailing winds from the west sweep the pollution into New England, resulting in more acid rain, smog, and mercury contamination of lakes and rivers. Senator Jeffords.
I was on the special committee that Senator Mitchell and Maine put together on the 1990 Clean Air Amendments. And so I'm kind of checking up on what happened. And first of all, we are finding that the statements that the old coal plants were going to go out and we could get clean coal burning plants hasn't proved to be true. We've had coal increasing at 16% in the last 5 years, and the old plants are still puffing away. So we're trying to bring some pressure on them. And in addition to that, of course, we want to try to increase the use of renewables and have a program which will set aside funds to help in that regard and also to promote the use of renewables increasingly over the years ahead.
The senator has introduced legislation to close the loophole and promote renewable energy. But he says there is no chance of getting it through committee. So his current strategy is to try to add his bill as an amendment to legislation to restructure and further deregulate utilities that may come to the Senate floor later this year. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We'll be right back. You can contact the Environment Show through our website. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We have another edition of the Environment Show quiz for you. Here's how it works. We play a sound. You then write us, identify the sound, and in 25 words or less, describe its environmental significance. Here's the sound. Again, the sound. In 25 words or less, identify the sound and describe its environmental significance. Email us your response at green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Or write the Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Again, that's the Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. The winner gets a towel made of organically grown cotton, complete with the Environment Show logo. We'll announce his or her name in a month, and I promise to be totally arbitrary and capricious during the selection process. Good luck. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Susan Zwinger, it's the Yukon in Canada, where a raven uncovers the beginning of terrestrial life. In this portrait of place, Zwinger reads from her book, The Last Wild Edge, One Woman's Journey from the Arctic Circle to the Olympic Rainforest.
I awaken on September 13th to find the world absolutely blank, except for two black eyes moving. For a frightening moment, I cannot figure out why all is stark white and the tundra has gone. It is so cold, every limb I move seems to freeze. To warm up the propane in my camp stove to the point where it will light, I grab the stove and hold it between my thighs. My bone marrow is frozen. Snow is solid in the air. A total whiteout, a blank sheet of photographic paper. Above the Arctic Circle, 66 degrees 33 minutes north, I lie in a black pickup near the Continental Divide in the Richardson Mountains. My only reality is a 6 foot by 4 foot by 4 foot aluminum and steel box whose volume I have reduced by half with a kitchen, library, bed, and camping gear. The back canopy window is solid with an icy fern forest grown from my body's night moisture. The thermometer says 8 degrees, and it's already been warming up for an hour. My own death lurks out there on soft, downy ptarmigan feet, as lovely as it is unseen. Hypothermia is a peaceful dream, first to sleep, then to dream, and then nothingness. I think that I am the only thing alive for miles and years and miles, but my solitude is far, far from real. Frozen chips of sky swirl around out there. Nearby in the whiteness arrives a reverberating musical croak, tuning itself up in pitch increments like gears of ebony wood cranking loudly. Black and polished, this sound comes out of a whiteout like a fist from a sleeve. Raven. The raven croaks again and hops down from a rocky outcrop to work through the snow. I struggle on more clothes, glad for his presence. He is trying to show me something, teaching me about the snow or something underneath it. But I will have to get out of the truck bed to see it. Raven, I groan, pulling on another layer. I don't want to do this, but he won't let go. I stoop to dig through the snow where he was digging and find it warmer, much warmer, beneath. I find the very beginning of terrestrial life after a glacier, the black mat of Electoria lichen. Clue! Croaks the raven and flaps off toward the North Pole, where the Earth drops away into space.
That was author Susan Zwinger reading from her book, The Last Wild Edge, One Woman's Journey from the Arctic Circle to the Olympic Rainforest. It's published by Johnson Books. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. It is bug-chasing time for Nature Conservancy officials in Wisconsin. Specifically, they're conducting surveys which began earlier this summer and will continue until the frost. With the help of volunteers and staff members, they comb prairie remnants in the southern and central part of the state. Steve Richter, land steward for the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin, describes how the insects are collected and counted.
For some of the hopping type of insects that hop and crawl through the prairies, we're using things such as nets called sweep nets that we just drag or pull through the flowers and grasses. The nets just kind of suck up the insects as you're sweeping through. We also actually convert what most people use as blowing or sucking up leaves in their yards, leaf blowers. We actually use those, and we're literally sucking up the insects into our a special net then that we would sort through.
Richter says for rare or threatened insects, surveyors count them visually without the use of nets. The Karner blue butterfly, a federally endangered insect that is light blue in color with orange dots on its hind wings, is among the most troubled insects found in Wisconsin. But not all the species that are counted are in danger of extinction.
There's a beautiful, large, monarch-like size butterfly called the regal fritillary. It's a butterfly that once was abundant all the way to the east coast of the United States in openings and prairie-like areas, and now is pretty much confined to less than a dozen sites east of the Mississippi River, and its population strongholds are west of the river where there's still large expanses of prairie. So that's a very showy, beautiful butterfly that we're spending a lot of time monitoring this summer.
Other butterfly species and insects like the red-tailed leafhopper are also commonly spotted during the surveys. Richter says the insect surveys help Nature Conservancy officials and others determine what areas are critical for maintaining biodiversity in the prairies of Wisconsin.
We use those to really determine what areas in the state we should be focusing our protection, acquisition efforts, as well as management efforts. Are we managing these prairies and sites safely and appropriately, keeping in mind, you know, areas for insects? So as an example is we may not do a nice spring burn and burn the entire prairie if we know these insects are there, because in some stages of their life they may be very vulnerable to fire, and we wouldn't want to literally kill them all off with a fire if at that stage they're in their eggs or caterpillar stage.
Richter says annual insect surveys help scientists and land stewards to understand the changes ecosystems go through over the years and determine the elements needed to maintain their health. Entomologists tell us that insects will inhabit our planet after humans become extinct. Just before the last of us disappears, do you think the bugs will be counting us? You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we talk green with Jesse Ventura, governor of Minnesota. Running on the Reform Party line, he beat both the Democratic and Republican candidates. The former professional wrestler and Navy SEAL says a fight about protecting a wetland in his neighborhood got him into politics in the first place. We have two reports about climate change. Officials from the Red Cross and Red Crescent societies in Switzerland say natural disasters have been particularly severe this year. And the World Watch Institute here at home says our own energy use is to blame. Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today, my guest is the governor of Minnesota, the Honorable Jesse Ventura, and you'll recall that he ran as a candidate of the Reform Party, which had been founded by Ross Perot, and he defeated a well-known Democrat and another well-known Republican in the general election for governor. And we're going to be talking about his approach to environmental and conservation issues and some of the challenges that his administration faces. Governor, welcome to the Environment Show.
Hi, Peter. How are you today?
Great that you're with us. As a national figure, I think a lot of our listeners around the country know about you, but not much about your views about the environment. What should they know?
Well, I guess if we were to go back, of course, many people didn't realize nationally that I actually served as mayor of the sixth largest city in Minnesota, which is a suburb of Minneapolis called Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. And I served there. I won the election of 1990, and I took office in January of 91 and served through January of 94. And the interesting about my run for mayor of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, was that what initially got me involved in local politics was an environmental issue. I lived in a very well-established older neighborhood along the Mississippi River, and we all had the old dirt roads. We had the best of both worlds. We had very country-style living, and yet we were only 15 minutes from downtown Minneapolis by the freeway. And we had ditches. We didn't have storm sewer, curb and gutter, or any of that. We didn't need it because no one had any water problems. Well, there were a few open spaces that a developer came in and purchased, and the developer then started pushing City Hall to come out and give us curb, gutter, and storm sewer, which we didn't need. And but he would profit from it greatly if we all helped foot the bill on the development that he was going to do, which we didn't oppose him developing because certainly everyone has the right to do so on land that they purchase. But the problem arose, what do you do with this water? You know, once you put in curb, gutter, and storm sewer, you have to channel the water somewhere. Well, we were only, of course, many of us lived right along the Mississippi River, and that is against the law, so they can't channel the water into the Mississippi River. but adjacent to the river, about a block from my home and a block from the local grade school, was a very natural big wetland. And that was what they determined where they were going to send all this storm water into the wetland. And, well, 450 of us signed a petition, and many of us are members of the Isaac Walton League, and we signed a petition saying that that was unacceptable, that we felt that it would damage and destroy this wetland. And this wetland was a breeding place for a lot of wildlife, frogs and amphibian life and all that. And we felt that, you know, no one needed this curb, gutter, and storm sewer to begin with except the developer who wanted it. And so 450 of us signed a petition saying that was unacceptable, and we took it to City Hall, and we were voted down 7-0. And so it was, you know, maybe.
And then you took on City Hall and beat them all, as I understand
well,
it.
Well, you know, it got to me a little because I thought, you know, maybe I could understand 5-2 or 4-3, but a slam dunk 7-0, I thought something's wrong here because these people are elected to represent us. And when 450 people in a neighborhood oppose something, I think that's quite a strong position. And so I started getting more involved, and lo and behold, I found out there were more neighborhoods that were just as angry with the current administration. And one day I was up there, and I made a statement, and I looked at the 20-year incumbent mayor, and I kind of off the cuff said, "You're going to make me run for mayor, aren't you?" And his friend, a fellow councilman, laughed and said, "You can't win."
And well, the rest is history.
Well, yeah, I walked out of the building that night knowing I was running for mayor because I don't like to be told I can't do something.
Governor, this...
So that was my initial step into politics, was over an exact environmental issue. And it was so bad, if I can go on a moment, we as a neighborhood had to go out. We formed a nonprofit corporation. We had to go out and hire an attorney to fight our own city hall.
And that has indeed been the history of lots of these fights. This raises an issue that I presume you're going to have to struggle with, and that is the whole question of sprawl and what happens to our cities given diminishing empty space and developers who would like to take some of that public space for their own. Is that something that you think you're going to have to be struggling with during your administration?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, we here in the Twin Cities right now probably are sprawling as bad as anywhere in the country, I think, around the Twin City metro area. And I think, you know, in some ways, sprawl is inevitable. I mean, we're humans, we're going to expand, and so you have to understand that in some manner it will happen. But I think what you need to do is a term that now is becoming very popular called smart growth, where you plan and you offer incentives to attract people to grow in a certain manner so that you can accommodate it. Because, see, if we allow just unlimited sprawl, it's going to bankrupt the government. Because there's no way you can put in the infrastructure for it. There's no way you can put in the sanitary sewer and water and all of that and the lines that you need to put in that way to handle it environmentally as well as economically. So you've got to take a proactive position on it, and you have to do what is called smart growth, where you offer incentives for development to happen on certain corridors, and then deal with it that way. And also going along with that is you want it to happen hopefully on land that is not fertile. You want to gear your sprawl towards the worst farmland, not the best farmland.
Which,
you know,
of course,
and so that again is part of smart growth.
And that indeed has been the history for so long, where the best farmland goes first. Another issue in this whole question of growth relates to whether there ought to be more or less public acquisition of land. I know there are some conservative groups that feel it's a bad idea for the government to buy land anyplace. Is that going to be an issue in Minnesota?
Well, I think Minnesotans are very much, we have a world-class park system here right now. I think if you come to the, and especially in the Twin City, not only throughout the state, which we are very much, you know, we're the land of 10,000 lakes, and the only reason they say 10,000 lakes, we have more than that. I think we just ran out of names. so we did. We couldn't name any more than 10,000 of them. But we're a very outdoor type of people up here in Minnesota, and we very strongly believe in an outdoor lifestyle. And so, you know, we do have a tremendous park system throughout the whole state of Minnesota, and most definitely in the Twin City metro area, we have award-winning park system here. In fact, the Twin Cities Marathon is labeled as being the most beautiful one in almost the whole world because it runs right through the Twin Cities park system, which connects all the lakes of Minneapolis and runs along the Mississippi River corridor. And, you know, they do an outstanding job, and something that we can be very proud of, that leadership prior to me, many years prior to me, took a proactive role in ensuring that the parks would be the best they could be. And that and so I don't think that's really a big problem here in Minnesota because it gets a lot of support from the citizens.
You mentioned wildlife, and Minnesota also is one of the few places with a healthy wolf population. And that raises all kinds of questions about the Endangered Species Act and ranchers and sportsmen and so on. Where does the wolf come out in the scheme of things in Minnesota today?
Well, first of all, I have some fun with you. The wolves took it heavy when Marbury left. Stephon Marbury,
right,
Timberwolves.
Right.
You know, so we had to recover from that, but we still have our mainstay wolf, Kevin Garnett, you know, the mainstay of the franchise. But I'm
okay.
Sure you're talking about the actual four-legged wolves. So,
well, there are all kinds of them, but let's talk about the canines.
We have all types of wolves up here. But, no, we're getting an overabundance of them, and again, I think the key is finding the happy median. You know, you certainly don't want to put any animal on the extinction list and see it disappear, and you obviously want to protect that. But then again, you don't want them to become overabundant also, to where they become a danger not only to themselves but to everything around them. So we're dealing with that problem right now, and I'm sure it could be a hot button item on at what level do you have the wolf population, because when it gets to the point where the wolves are doing raiding runs down north of the Twin Cities and becoming, you know, dangerous in some ways, well, then you have to deal with it, you know, because that can happen. But I think that, you know, we have a great DNR commissioner in Al Garber here who's phenomenal, and we've got a history of having a tremendous, I think, good relationship with our animal population as well as our people population. So I have all the confidence in the world that we will find results and reach that happy median on where the wolf can survive and the humans can survive and we can both coexist.
Working out ways by which we can make all this happen given various interests also involves forestry issues. I know the Forest Resources Council in the past had been a matter of some dispute in Minnesota. The environmental folks said it was represented only timber interests. I gather you have moved to keep it going, and my environmental friends tell me you have done a great deal to bring some balance to that institution. Is that something that will be useful as your administration deals with forestry issues?
Yes, and again, it comes down to a balance issue, as you stated, a happy median. You know, certainly you know, we need trees to you know, in our daily lives to do what we do as humans. But again, you don't want to sacrifice them. So I think it's being educated in what you do and in how you harvest your trees, that you don't come in and just clear out an entire area of trees, that you pick and choose and thin them. You know, and that way it's actually more healthy for the trees too. Because
sure.
So when the trees get too packed together, then they become detrimental to themselves. And so you use a thinning process where it works very well. And again, I think a good word to use is called common sense.
But isn't the tough issue there that the thing that makes common sense, as we all describe it, may to the property owners say, hey, your common sense is on my property, and I'm going to cut my trees the way I feel like it. And indeed, that's what we're hearing in a lot of places. Is that an issue that's going to make it tough to exercise common sense?
You know, a private property issue is always a tough issue because, you know, there's the old saying, if you pay the taxes on the land, you kind of should have choice of what you do with the land as long as it doesn't affect or detrimental to other people. And so, again, you try to find a mediation point of saying, yeah, we want to respect private property rights, but we certainly don't want to harm the environment in so doing it. But again, I think you got to handle each case on its its own merit. You can't just do blanket statements and come across the board with, look, it's going to be this way or that way. I think you have to take each case on an individual basis and make your determination as such.
That is one that raises a lot of emotion. When I was environmental when I was environmental commissioner of the state of New York, the only thing I would regularly get death threats on was that issue.
Well, you're lucky. Try being a governor. You get them on more things.
I'm sure you do. Let me ask you something about the EPA. Every governor struggles with the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. They both give you money, but they tell you what to do. Have you found that your relationships with them have been workable from your perspective?
Well, I'm probably a little early yet. I haven't noticed any thorn in my side from them at this point. You know, I haven't really had a run-in with them, per se. So maybe I haven't been in office long enough because I've only been here a half a year. But I think, like in everything, you know, I'm a great believer in states' rights. And certainly, though, in some instances, and the environment is one, you've got to have a federal overseeing of environment, because we certainly don't want one state polluting, say, a river that then flows into another state. So, you know, I'm a believer in state rights, but again, in the case of the environment, I think you need a good, solid policy from the federal level on it, because, again, you know, environment things, smoke and air pollution and things of that nature, there's no border. States are simply lines drawn on maps. And there's no border to the land. And so I support the EPA and the job that they do, but you have to be careful too, because you don't want the federal government, and I know this from being a mayor, there's nothing worse than what they call an unfunded mandate, to where a higher government agency will order you to do something, and generally when they order you to do something, there's a price tag that comes with it, and they don't send the money. So
nor do they have to vote for the taxes, local taxes, that will produce it.
Exactly. And so I'm a great believer that if the government, if a higher level of government is going to mandate something to a lower level of government, that along with that should come the accompanying funds, if funds are indeed needed.
Governor, I want to thank you.
I'm a strong believer in that. I do not believe in any unfunded mandates. If they're going to mandate, then you pay for it at the level you're mandating it at.
I want to thank you. I'm afraid our time is up. My guest has been Governor Jesse Ventura from Minnesota, and I'm sure the governor has said some things that you may want to comment on. So share your thoughts with us. Our toll-free number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Regular mail is 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Officials from the Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Geneva, Switzerland, say it's been a very bad year for natural disasters around the globe, and say it looks as though things are going to get worse. According to relief experts and scientists, more natural disasters like floods and hurricanes are affecting the environment and the lives of millions of people. Most scientists believe greenhouse gases that trap heat in the atmosphere are causing global warming, which is disrupting weather patterns.
We have two reports on how climate change is affecting us and what needs to be done to stop the warming trend. The first comes from Peter Capella of Swiss Radio International.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies calls them super disasters. Natural disasters like floods, earthquakes, and storms that will grow in frequency and severity over the next decade. The Red Cross says the trend is already taking hold. In the last 6 years, the number of people seeking help after floods and earthquakes has increased tenfold to more than 5.5 million. There were three times as many major floods last year as in the previous decade. And the trend fits with what's happened worldwide since the 1950s. The blame is being placed firmly on global warming and climate change. Margareta Wallström coordinates disaster response at the International Federation.
Whether this is cyclical or not, the reality is that we live in one of these cycles where we will be more frequently seeing and be exposed to extreme climatic events. And those are the events that we note at international level because they normally generate international relief for the people affected by those disasters. And among the most serious extreme climatic events are floods. Not because they kill a huge number of peoples, but because the economic consequences are so grave that they affect people's lives, communities' lives, and nations' lives.
The hardest hit are in developing countries, and the effects of natural disasters are reinforced by poverty and conflict. Few have the benefit of insurance. Prevention and protection is an ideal way to mitigate both the human and economic cost, according to the report. But in the meantime, it's up to insurers to foot part of the bill, and they're facing increasing losses. More than $92 billion can be attributed to natural disasters, according to one of the world's largest reinsurance companies. After a series of billion-dollar storms in the Caribbean, some insurers are now refusing to provide cover in the region. The other alternative is development aid and relief. But Mrs. Wallström warns that's less likely too.
If we see that the international community should respond to this as a humanitarian issue, we are today in a situation of declining volumes of international aid. Both international development aid, but also even if Kosovo has provided a positive blip on that screen, with declining volumes of relief aid.
Yet the Red Cross says more is needed now, and even more in the future, even without wars. Peter Capella in Geneva.
This is the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott. World Watch Institute, the nonprofit public policy research organization, agrees with the predictions made by other international bodies who say global warming is changing the Earth's climate. In recent months, World Watch released a detailed report titled Vital Signs 1999, The Environmental Trends That Are Shaping Our Future. It addresses a number of problems facing the planet, including global warming, energy and automobile usage, and population growth. Chris Flavin is Senior Vice President at World Watch Institute.
1998 was the warmest year since recording of global average temperatures began roughly 130 years ago. And it was exacerbated in part by the very strong El Nino last year, but scientists have since re-jiggled the numbers and determined that even if you took out the consequences of El Nino, it would have been a record.
Some believe global warming is causing more El Nino and La Nina events, while others say such events and global warming can be attributed to cyclical changes. But most scientists agree global warming is the leading cause of changing weather patterns that include destructive storms and natural disasters that are occurring more frequently. Last year, they created more damage than any other year in recorded history, $91 billion worldwide.
The two really dominant weather-related disasters in 1998 were the huge floods in the Yangtze Basin of central China, which resulted in a population of being displaced from their homes, of well over 100 million people being uprooted at least temporarily, and literally tens of billions of dollars of economic damage on a very wide scale. I mean, it would be as if the Mississippi River were flooded for most of the summer, but then increased the population around the Mississippi River by a factor of about 10 to understand the enormous human and economic consequences.
Flavin says Honduras and parts of Central America also suffered a lot of destruction from a massive hurricane named Mitch. He says some estimate that economic development there has been set back by several decades as a result of the storm. Flavin says unless the emission of greenhouse gases is reduced, the trend of destructive weather patterns spurred by climate change will continue.
Well, the problem, as I see it, is that the U.S. is the number one emitter of greenhouse gases by far. It also emits more than just about any other country on a per capita basis. We emit basically twice what the Europeans do per person, and you know, roughly 10 times what the Chinese do, and 20 times what India produces per person. So, you know, this problem is to some extent, you know, made in America. We basically developed the fossil fuel model the rest of the world followed. And I think we do have a responsibility to lead the way out.
The good news is that humans are beginning to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, something Flavin says must be done if humans are going to slow the effects of global warming. He says more competitive forms of energy, such as solar and wind power, are emerging. Another positive sign is the emergence of the fuel cell.
Fuel cells, I believe, are a revolutionary new technology that has the potential to help spur a dramatic transformation of the world energy system. I mean, I think they are as important in creating what we describe as the coming solar hydrogen age as the internal combustion engine was in creating the oil age that we're now living through the latter stages of.
One type of fuel cell is currently being designed for home use. It would be about the size of a dishwasher, operate on natural gas or propane, and emit little CO2. The unit should produce enough electricity to power a four-bedroom home and enable a homeowner to remove him or herself from the power grid. Fuel cells are also changing the way we travel.
They also have the potential to be the replacement for the internal combustion engine in automobiles. And in the long run, both the fuel cell in your basement and the fuel cell in your car will run not on natural gas, but eventually on pure hydrogen, hydrogen that will be derived from water using solar energy, wind power, bioenergy, and other renewable energy forms.
Flavin says he is hopeful that human ingenuity will deal with global warming, which he describes as one of the most daunting problems we have ever faced. He says the key is developing technologies that can be applied here and in the big developing countries like Indonesia, Brazil, India, and China, so their growing economies do not cause huge increases in greenhouse gas emissions. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If Governor Jesse Ventura went out to Vail, Colorado, he could put both the protesters and the forest rangers in their place and still have energy left to wrestle the lynx if emission from coal plants don't asphyxiate him. Get a copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262, order show number 500 to follow the action. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for The Environment Show.